What was the premise of the post that you wrote? It was called The Web We Lost. Mm-hmm. And for, you know, there's a certain sector of this tech scene who certainly read it. But for those who didn't, can you sort of describe in layman's terms what it was about?
Absolutely. The fundamental underpinning was that there was a community of us that had been on the web for 15, 20 years and had a set of values, especially in the early days of the social web, when blogging was being born, when social networks were being born, that talked about what the implications of this technology was on culture, on society. There was an ethos, and it felt almost like when a town has a scene with a bunch of bands that all play together, and they might have a battle of the bands and compete, but they're all looking for a certain sound, and they're all sort of helping each other out, and maybe the drummer from one band fills in for the other when there's a gig. And that sense is sort of evaporated as the social networks got to scale, got to 1 billion people on Facebook and 500 million people on Twitter. And I'm very happy the social networks have succeeded, but it's been at the cost of a couple capabilities and abilities that used to be there that somehow we just don't talk about anymore.
You sort of have said that something died, a spirit died as we moved on. And what spirit is that? And is it because of those platforms in particular?
You know, I think death, it might be the sort of overstatement of me being an old timer and lamenting. I might be lamenting my lack of youth as opposed to what happened on the technology side. But it is, to a certain degree, they don't share that ethos. And some of it's natural. I mean, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was in junior high school when we were doing that work. So it doesn't make sense that he would care that much about it. So some of it is absolutely attributable to the social networks got big. Their business models were frankly different. We didn't anticipate, you know, advertising on a social network to be a multi-billion-dollar business back then. So, of course, they've got different priorities. I don't ascribe malice to it. But at the same time, there is an ignorance or a lack of history to the way that a lot of the people that build the social networks, and a lot, especially the young engineers, think about this because they weren't around to see when it was any other different way. And the analogy I always use here is, you look at television, it was around for 30 years before I Love Lucy shows up. And that idea of the sitcom is a natural format here. Now it seems obvious in retrospect that that's a great format for TV. But for decades, it wasn't true. And so there's all this experimental, interesting stuff going on. You've got Milton Berle in a dress, and you've got people reading cigarette ads, and this crazy stuff that wouldn't happen after that. And having been on the other side of it, having been from that early, you know, sort of set of pioneers and watching what my brilliant friends got to do, some of that experimentation died off with good reason because it wasn't good ideas. But a lot of it was the idea of just empowering people in ways that had something to do other than just delivering ads to them.
Okay, so we're talking about a certain group of people who had an ethos about all for one, one for all. Let's figure this out together. It's going to benefit us as a community, as a world, potentially. Mm-hmm. Why should anyone, lay people, care about this? What does this mean for them, losing this world?
There's a couple simple things. The example I always go back to, and the refrain that has gotten stuck in my head, is when people have a house fire, the thing that they always say is, well, we got everybody out safe, if hopefully they did, and we grabbed our wedding photos, and everything else is just stuff. It's replaceable, right? So the declaration, the most important thing is physically we're intact and we got our wedding photos. And the first thing that happens in Silicon Valley when they declare success for somebody that makes a startup is, well, we got bought by Facebook and we're going to shut down our service in a month and we're rich now, but by the way, we're going to delete your wedding photos, right? And it happens over and over and over, and it could be bought by Twitter, it could be bought by Google, but that idea that you just delete somebody's content as a matter of course is anathema to, I think, the values of the early social web, where it was treating with some reverence the fact that we've got people's baby pictures and wedding photos and even the trivial moments that you don't know if they matter later. Those unexpected things that, oh, it turns out that was the first time I ever met my wife and I didn't know it, but I happened to have tweeted about it or blogged about it or something like that, that later on becomes incredibly significant. Those moments being preserved, and that the content and the things we share and the ideas we share are the most important thing, that was the first fundamental thing that I think we've started to compromise on, to the degree where even if the data are there somewhere, even if our information is buried away in a server.
Yeah, because that's what everybody always tells us. Oh, well, whatever you do online, it'll exist forever. But you're saying that's not really the case.
No, I think it's there. That's true in a literal sense. But in the practical sense, if I want to find the first time I ever replied to my wife on Twitter, I can't go and find it. So if we say it's there theoretically, but in any pragmatic level, it's not there, it's not actually part of culture, then it's gone.
So what's the lesson to this? Should everybody back up everything to the nth degree? Or are you talking about a cultural shift in terms of what we trust to the internet?
I think it's both. I think some of it has to be, you know, and I'm sure there are apps, you know, I'm trying to build one. I'm doing a startup around some of these ideas. But more importantly is the culture in those who are creating these apps, those in Silicon Valley, the brilliant kids graduating from Stanford. The first thing they could do is just learn about the history of the industry that comes before them. You know, computer software has been around for almost 50 years now. And in every other industry, when you get to 50 years in, you start to say, oh, these are the patterns. This is a cycle we're following. There tends to be these kinds of shifts. They're not really familiar with that. If you ask most of the young folks about what was it like when people started using Microsoft Office, you know, they'll look at you like you're talking about ancient history. And it's not 100 years ago. You know, the lessons learned of how to compete, how to let people export their spreadsheets and pull them into another application, that kind of stuff. That was only 25 years ago that was a really common behavior. And so that's a cultural shift that also, I think it breaks down into even me being able to share data in interesting ways. So the first thing that happened as soon as Facebook bought Instagram was they shut off the ability on Twitter for you to import your Twitter friends and find your friends on Instagram through Twitter, because Facebook and Twitter are enemies right now.
Yeah.
That doesn't benefit any user. I understand what the benefits are to the shareholders of those two companies, but a user just wants to find their friends and share their photos with them. And there used to be a time when you put the goals and desires of that user ahead of the corporate infighting and battles.
But isn't there something to be said for when we turn the web into one big corporate playground, essentially, mm-hmm. right? But at the same time, isn't it only places like Facebook or Google who can have the resources to make massive innovations?
Well, massive and innovation don't necessarily always go together, right? I think one of the things that is interesting is, you know, Twitter started as a very small team making a small product. Now it's reached enormous scale, and that's great. But a lot of the innovations happen from the sort of classic two kids in a garage, or, you know, two young women in a dorm room building an app. Like, that kind of stuff, as much as there's a mythology around it, actually is true. You start from these little companies. The question is, does that little company get a chance to keep expanding and iterating and evolving? Or do they see success as we cash in, we go to work for this big company, they shut down our app, and that innovation gets sort of pulled into this existing network?
And this is the point where you say, Neil, those young people, these kids they today. Don't know what it used to be like.
Yeah, you know, and I know some of this is me being a crotchety old man. Like, I'm perfectly comfortable with that. I think the balance...
And how old are you, Neil?
37.
Right, so that's crotchety in this world.
Okay. Oh, yeah. By tech startup, I'm definitely the old guy. I've got gray hairs in my beard, and, you know, that makes you ancient. And what's great about that, having that perspective, is you also get to see that there's cycles to this stuff. The pendulum swings back and forth. So, you know, 15 years ago, we had everything centralized on one big network called AOL. And, you know, a third of the users in the U.S. got their access to the internet by dialing up through AOL. And people said, that's entrenched forever. They'll never be knocked down from this pedestal.
Because we all love that sound.
but it seemed impossible that there'd be any other place that we'd share our photos or go into a chat room or do any of the other things that people did on AOL.
Well, you're bringing up a really good point. You're talking about changing the way people in the tech industry think about property and what success is, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. But what about users? I mean, I remember when I first started using email in 1995, for the first 2 months, I printed out all the most important emails because I wanted to save them. I put holes in them and put them in a binder. Okay, so that lasted about 2 months.
Right.
And now I download a new app. Do I even read the privacy statements? No.
Never.
Who has time, right? So does there have to be also more fear put into the consumer that you don't know what you're doing and you should care? I know you're busy, but...
I think it's not fear, it's education. And actually, it's interesting. When I want to preserve something now, I take the paper and scan it and put it in the computer. Right? That's the permanent copy.
And then do you put it up to the cloud?
Well, sometimes, right? And I think that's the part of it is not having all your eggs in one basket. So I like Google Drive and I like Microsoft SkyDrive and I like Dropbox. And what about maybe using them all? So that one of those companies, when they inevitably change their terms of service and creeps me out, I've got another place to go. And that's my good fortune to have been educated enough to say those are all good options. And plus, I have my own hard drive at home and I got a copy in all those places. But that's a lot to ask for normal people, to learn all about all this stuff. We're busy. Like, you're living your life. You don't want to be reading terms of service and understanding all this stuff. So some of the burden shifts to the people creating the technology to think on behalf of the user. Can we make the default experience one that respects their privacy, one that respects the permanence of their data, one that respects their preferences about who they share with, one that respects their goals of communicating to people regardless of what network they're on? Those are things, to some degree, it'll be the place of public policy, right? We'll have laws about social networking just like we do about the telephone system or anything else. That'll be part of it. But some of it has to be a cultural shift among the people who make the technology to say, even if we're in some petty fight with another social network and we see them as our sworn enemy, we're still not going to cut off people's ability to share stuff because grandma and grandpa still want to see their grandkids' pictures, and they might have chosen a different phone or they might have chosen a different social network, but we're going to do what's right.
Do you think that the future of this also has to do with changing the fact that we expect everything to be for free these days? Because I understand when a company says to me, babe, you've been getting it for free. You don't have a leg to stand on when we change our terms of service.
Yeah, I think that's an aspect of it. I think the economics are important. I would quibble. We say free when we mean ad supported. And, you know, I think anybody listening to this show knows the difference between free and ad supported. And there's a lot of different ways to be free. We just need a range of economic options. Ad-supported is great. I don't think we would have billion-scale social networks and all the great things they enable without having ad-supported. But we need to also have simple ways to pay for things. I think actually a great model for this is a lot of people are paying for music and movies on iTunes and on Amazon and everywhere else. There's no reason that we can't have social networks that follow the same model as apps like Angry Birds. And it's really easy for us to think of, oh, I pay $4 and let my kid play with this app. I may want to look at photo sharing that way. I may want to look at just messaging my friends that way, especially if I can understand there's these other benefits to it.
Neil, I mean, lastly, I just want to ask you, Google has come up with this new thing called Inactive Account Manager, basically a very bland way of saying, like, if you die or something happens to you, you can now specify what you want to happen to all of your goodies with us. Mm-hmm. What do you think of it?
It's a great step. You know, there's the first important part is you have somebody in the technology industry talking about real life and the fact that death is part of it and birth is part of it and people with different physical abilities are part of it. That's incredible. That's a huge maturity for the industry to reckon with, and it's really important. You know, at a practical level, my digital assets are among the most important artifacts of me. You know, I have a little boy, and I think a lot about the things he's going to judge me by and look at when I'm gone. Is going to be the things I've written. You know, right? What is already 15 years of writing my blog, and hopefully will be 75 years of writing my blog by the time I'm gone. He's going to be able to look at and say, this is who Dad was and how he evolved and how he changed. That's as important an artifact as anything else we would do. And we knew this hundreds of years ago. When the founding fathers wrote letters to each other, they knew those letters would be published posthumously. They knew those would be the record of their intellectual thinking. They knew this was the declaration of who they were as people. And this is just that cycle coming back around again 250 years later of people saying who I wrote to, what I wrote to them is a record of who I was and should be treated with that kind of respect.
I have this theory that Facebook was created because people are afraid of death, that they want to live so much in the moment and feel as though they can have connections with everybody in their life for the rest of time, and that they don't accept that things end and they don't come back. So that's my own morbid little theory. Do you think that there is something to be said that people, that technology is making us think about the present constantly and putting away the things that aren't so fun to think about?
You know, I think it's actually, technology reflects everything we care about. And so, you know, there's certainly a strong argument that Facebook was started in order to help college kids hook up with one another, right? So that's sort of the beginning of life. And then you have the other extreme, which is the, you know, let me create a record of me that'll live on past my own life. I think those are the highest aspirations of what technology can do, is to bookend everything that we create from the moment that, you know, our parents think of us to that the last moments we have is saying, this is who I was, this is how I lived, this is what mattered to me. In a literal sense, this is what I liked. And hopefully some meaning can be teased out of that. The question is, can we treat with reverence and respect and importance what ordinary people do and share in the same way we do with the richest and the most famous and the most popular?
Anil, thanks a lot.
Thank you.